Hello and welcome to today's all-English episode of Neon Ghost Ghost Hour, your pop culture podcast. Thanks for tuning in again. I'm your host, Benjamin Fiege. This week I have a special guest for you. I talk with the British songwriter and composer Ross Godfrey, co-founder and guitarist of the iconic trip-hop band Modcheeba. Together we dive into Modcheeba's new album Escape the Chaos, we discuss the impact of Brexit on the British music scene, and Ross' relationship with his brother Paul. Have fun and hit that subscribe button. Recommend us to your friends and family if you like what you hear, and if not, to your worst enemies.
Neon Ghosts. Ghost Hour. A pop culture podcast.
Hello.
Hey. Hi.
I made it. I'm actually on a vacation with my family. We're down in a very small town on the Kent coast called Hythe, which is near Folkestone. Is where the Channel Tunnel goes through from France to England, right where it meets England in the corner there. That's where I am. And this is where I grew up, actually. This is my hometown.
Awesome. Back to the roots.
Yeah. We're seeing my family, and I have two daughters, and so they're spending time with their grandmother, and you know, we're doing Easter activities.
Okay.
Yeah, it's nice. I normally live in London, and in South London, and so it's nice to come down here, you know, when the schools are on break and the weather is nice. And so yeah, we are very lucky, and it's only an hour drive, so that's good.
So you're staying there for the most of April now, or?
Yeah, I mean, I have to go tomorrow to do a rehearsal with the band, and then we have a TV show in Paris on Wednesday and some radio, and then I'm back here again for a couple of weeks. And then we have a new album out in the middle of May. So things starting to get busy, you know, and we're doing lots of promo, and the band is getting ready, and then we've got a full summer of festivals, and then in October, we're going to do a big tour of Europe to support the record. And we'll be coming to Germany then. I think we've got three shows in Germany in October.
Yeah. Is that set in stone, or might there be more shows added to?
I think that'll be it for this year. But we hope to come back next year and do some of the markets that we missed. So I'm hoping that we can come back. And there's a few places I haven't been to in a long, long time, like when we first started on our very first tour, we went to Wuppertal.
Oh, yeah.
And we did a gig there. And then we had like 3 days off in Wuppertal. And it was really nice. I really liked it. So I'd like to go back there and ride, you know, on the funny train with the elephant.
Okay. Yeah, we had an interview a long time ago, 2012 or 2013. At the Gibson.
Yeah. I think I remember. It's what is the name of the theater in Frankfurt where we played?
I think it was Gibson.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, the Gibson Theater. Yeah, I remember. And I like Frankfurt. It's nice. It's I like we're both Sky and I are like big fans of German food and just general sort of German well organized events and things. When we go on tour, we will always look forward to going to Germany, because we know everything will be organized very well, and the backstage is very tidy, the food is very nice. Germany and Switzerland are probably our favorite places to tour in Europe. Yeah, we're looking forward to coming back, and we're going to try and play some of the new record, as well as, you know, a mixture of older stuff. It's weird now that we've been going for nearly 30 years. I mean, it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel that long. And this is our 11th album that we're releasing. I mean, actually, it's the 12th album if you include the Sky and Ross record, which is kind of like a Chiba record. So when we write a set list, it takes a really long time to go through all of the different records and think, what songs do we like from this? And which songs do we think the fans will want to hear? And it's quite a difficult process because, I mean, the easy thing to do is go on Spotify and see which are, you know, the most popular 10 songs are.
Yeah. But
it's always nice to bring some more, you know, sort of esoteric random songs from the back catalogue and play just to see if there's any proper old school fans out there that listen to all the records.
Bands with your vast catalogue, I hear that a lot in recent times. They make surveys. They ask fans which song would you like to us to play on the upcoming tour. And yeah. I talked to the guy from Alphabill. I don't know if you know them. Big in Japan, Forever Young. He made a survey like that, and he was so disappointed that the fans did not vote for a song he really wanted to play on that tour.
I can imagine that happens a lot. Yeah, I mean, we tend to like pretty much the same songs as the fans, but sometimes I think it really depends on the situation. If we were in like a really nice classy theater and everybody's sat down in like, you know, red velvet chairs, then we kind of play everything a bit more mellow and atmospheric. But if we're in like a sweaty nightclub and everyone is really high and happy and they've had a few drinks, then we play more energetic and we kind of rock out and we get everyone to sing and dance. So we have to kind of read the room to work out what is the best, ambiance for the set of the evening. And I mean, it's a shame. We've played some German festivals before, but we hardly ever get invited to play German festivals because I think a lot of them are very heavy rock orientated. Because when we play outside, it's very different as well. I think we are doing one festival in Austria this year. I think it's the Butterfly Festival in Austria. But we would love to come and play more German festivals. It just doesn't seem that there's many that would have our kind of music.
Yeah, maybe one of the promoters hears it.
Yes.
Your new album is called Escape the Chaos. In these chaotic, turbulent days, how difficult is that even for you to escape? How do you do that?
It's pretty impossible. I mean, the trouble is, wherever you go, whatever you do, you're always carrying one of these around. And this is just like a portal to absolute chaos. I mean, I used to live in America, and I've got a lot of friends there. And I think everybody's pretty horrified with what's going on at the moment. And, you know, so I'm just constantly getting messages, or if I go on my Instagram feed, all it is about people blowing up Teslas and, you know, worrying that the whole world economic system is going to crash. And, you know, you've got the rise of the sort of far right in lots of different countries. And I mean, with ourselves, I think we got in there early with Brexit. We got our craziness out of the way quickly. And now we're hoping to maybe mend some fences. But it seems to be just everywhere. Everyone has gone mad. And I can't help but just blame kind of disinformation and misinformation. I think that the social media has a lot to answer for. People have just gone crazy. I mean, and there's a huge rise in things like, you know, anti-science. People are anti-vaccination. They don't even believe that the moon exists. They think we live on a flat earth. It's bonkers. It's like living through the opposite of a renaissance. It's like we're going back into the dark ages where everyone's just really fucking stupid.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of chaos out there. And we try to use music, I think, as therapy. It's a cathartic process. You know, when I was young, I learned to play the guitar I really loved old blues music, like old ragtime blues, people like Blind Boy Fuller and Skip James, you know, the really old stuff, Blind Lemon Jefferson. And I just used to sit and play the guitar all the time. And it was like a meditation, and it made me feel much better. And all of my internal anxiety would just kind of melt away. And so I think I'm trying to still use music like that now. And we want to make a record where people can get home from work and they can shut the front door and they can put on our record and they can just like travel off into a different atmosphere, you know, a blissful kind of dream for a while, because it's very difficult to get away from the chaotic nature of the world, and you're constantly confronted with people that violently disagree with you. I don't really remember this in the past. I think before technology took over our lives so much, even if you disagreed politically with someone that lived in your village or whatever, you would still get on and you would still be very friendly. You just would disagree about some policies that the government were using or something like that. But now everybody just wants to kill each other. Mm. And it's not a good thing. It's very scary. And I'm hoping that people see how stupid it is and they start to kind of take down the volume.
Is that something you guys experience also maybe in like the friend circle or even family circle? You meet people with different political views and now it's really something that's difficult to ignore?
Well, in the UK, Brexit was the thing that made everybody, you know, enemies within their own families. And it's gone so badly that I think that everybody realizes that it was a very bad idea. And we knew that from the start. Well, most people did. But I think it was very much a protest vote, you know, and people just wanted to change or they wanted to stick their fingers up at the government. And unfortunately, it was like shooting yourself in the foot. It's been very bad for our economy and for us. I mean, as a band, it's very difficult now. We have to get Carnage to take the equipment through to Europe, and we have to get visas for different countries. We can't even take our own vehicles to Europe because they're only allowed to go to one country and they have to come back. And before Brexit, the touring industry in the UK was huge. I mean, it made billions and billions of pounds. And, you know, for instance, an American band would come to London and they would hire all their equipment and their road crew and they would rehearse and then take British trucks and go and tour Europe. And now none of that can happen. So what was a multi-billion pound industry has just disappeared completely. Mm-hmm. And the government did try to do anything to save it. You know, a good analogy is, you know, the music was about 10 times bigger than the fishing industry. And they spent months and months and months arguing about which fishing boats could go where and who was allowed how many fish and everything. But nobody even mentioned the music business. And it's a real shame because British music has always been, highly rated around the world. But I think that especially the conservative side of the government in the UK knew that no musicians would ever vote for them. So they weren't, you know, they weren't losing any friends, as it were. They didn't care about us. So it's just been quite hard, really, you know. And if you know people that voted for Brexit, it's difficult to get past, you know, knowing that they've just destroyed the industry that I worked in. And they've made so many people's lives miserable. You know, now students can't go and study in Europe, or, you know, I have my wife is French. So we have two daughters, and luckily they've got French passports, so they can go and come as they please. But it really made everyone's life smaller, unnecessarily. You know, everybody's now poorer, and they're less free to travel and do what they want. And there was quite a big lie that, you know, it was about bringing down immigration, and now immigration is three or four times higher than it was before Brexit. So it was all based on lies, and that made a lot of people angry. And we're hoping slowly by slowly we can kind of come back to the family, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Speaking about challenges for touring artists, will also be interesting to see how the new policy in the US will affect bands in future.
They just
Think of
look at their
like
social media and they say, "You said something bad about Donald Trump, you're not coming in." So I think we won't go to USA. We'll go and do a big tour of Canada, and then we'll just fly down to Mexico and do some Mexican dates and just miss out America.
Yeah, speaking about all these catastrophes, the last one was the pandemic, and in this one you recorded your latest album to this point, Blackest Blue. For the new record, were there any parallels in how you recorded? Did anything stick from the way you did it in the pandemic, or did you went back the way you did it before?
Yeah, we use some of it because it's quite convenient to, just send stuff back and forth. I write a guitar piece and I send it to Sky. She'll write a melody and send it back to me, and it's okay like that, but you lose some of the spontaneity and the feeling, the feedback between the people. So this time we went to a studio in Dublin, and recorded with a producer and songwriter over there. And we were all in the same room, and we had Jager, Sky's son, playing drums, and Steve, her husband, on bass, and I was playing the guitar. And it felt like, the old days where a band would actually be in the room and you'd write something and play together. So that felt really good to have that sense of community again within the music. And we also did a couple of sessions in London, with the brass and with we did a song called Hold It Down, which was actually recorded almost live completely with the band in the studio. And so that was refreshing. So I would say it was a mixture. It was a bit of the work from home style, and it was a little bit of the going to the studio style, which was nice. And it was a fresh change because I feel like music now, music production is becoming a little bit too lonely. Like you spend a lot of time just with you and a computer and not enough time, vibing off your friends and your co-musicians. Because I would spend 12, 14, 16 hours a day in the studio on my own, and the only reaction I would get would be from my cat sitting next to me. And even though I love my cat, it's not still not like it's not a great vibe. You want to have some energy, so it was a
All
bit of
the
a
songs
change.
cat approved, so to
Yeah, something it'd be like that.
speak. Is it always clear after every Mochiba album that there will be a next one, or are you guys also like many people now just push out singles? Like the album format is not a given.
I find making albums a very big job. They're very it's a it takes a lot of work over a long period of time. This record took just under 2 years, and I think I probably spent about 5,000 hours in the studio, and it does drive you mad. But I do feel like if it doesn't drive you mad, then you're not doing it good enough. You've got to go to the edge of madness before you can finish. And I think that maybe on the next record we will do. I quite enjoy collaborating with some other producers and writers. And so I think maybe we can do that more because the last before this record, the last two before that, Sky and I wrote nearly everything, and I produced them. And we're very aware of what we're capable of. And sometimes it's nice to bring someone else in to help give you a fresh perspective, or just to have a different idea, because I guess we get a little bit bored with what we can do, because we've been doing it for so long. So I think, yeah, on the next record, maybe I just sit in the corner and smoke a joint and play the guitar, and someone else can press the buttons.
It's legal now in Germany, by the way. Don't know. I
It's
think
what? It's legal.
weed is legal now in Germany.
Good. Well, hopefully it'll be here. I mean, I do have a medical cannabis card, and they send me little bottles of oil, and I put it under my tongue before I go to bed, and I sleep like a baby.
Since you mentioned songwriting, how does it differ from like 30 years ago when you started out? Nowadays, it seems like many songwriters have TikTok in mind, all that stuff that comes with that, those 50 seconds that have to be compatible with
what. Yeah.
Is that something that plays a role when you guys write songs or not at all?
Not really. I mean, I would say that our intros are shorter. That's just a general thing across music. People don't have very long intros anymore because nobody has the patience to listen to, you know, let alone a minute. Like, they don't even listen to 10 seconds of music. They will just skip it forward to get to the singing or whatever. And so I think maybe that our songs are more concise. They don't. Sometimes we would jam for like 10 minutes, you know, and it would be like, I don't know, like a Grateful Dead or Electric Ladyland kind of thing. But on this record, everything is reasonably like concise. There's a song called Bleeding Out that there's a long fuzz guitar solo on the end, which was really good fun to do. I kind of see music as more like trance-like, like a meditation. And so in the last couple of years, I've really gone off social media. I find it quite painful. And so I'm not really influenced by what it would look like on social media. I try to make music that sounds good when you take magic mushrooms and sit on a comfy chair.
One song, I break my tongue trying to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Pareidolia?
Yes, pareidolia, yes.
It's about seeing faces in surfaces or stuff like that. Yeah. What does that have something to do with those moments that you just described? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, like the human brain always wants to make patterns and contacts. Hold on a sec. Mm-hmm. So the human brain wants to make connections and patterns. When it sees like a piece of wood, you imagine like a little cartoon character, or when you look at a rock, you can see a face or something. And in music is similar. Like, I mean, I can listen to any noise and hear like a rhythm or a pattern or some harmony, you know. Like when I go to the supermarket and walk around, all the fridge freezers humming to me sound like a Buddhist chant or a meditation, you know, and I'm like, So I think I always naturally hallucinate with my eyes and my ears, and I imagine things that aren't there, and I live in maybe a world that my brain creates, and that's nice. And the song Pareidolia I recorded with my wife, Amanda Zamolo, who is a French singer who we worked with from the album Dive Deep, and she was also on Blaze Away on the song Mezcal Dream. So we just made this song like, I don't know, like a psychedelic jam. And Sky suggested that we use a flute player from Colombia. Mm-hmm. And he plays the gaita flute, which is like a long, looks a little bit like an oboe. And he was in London when Sky met him, but he went back to Colombia. So I had to contact him in Colombia and send him the music and get him to record it and send it back. And it was a very big process, but I was very, very happy with it because the flute gives it a kind of otherworldly, like a shamanic atmosphere, which I really, really love. It's probably one of my favorite tracks on the record.
Mm-hmm. Since you say like it happens all the time, what was the latest hallucination or discovery?
I don't know. Because we're by the seaside now. I grew up here, but I spend a lot of time like looking at the sea and just letting my mind wander, you know, and it's a beautiful inspiration. I mean, as you probably know, we've got a song called The Sea. And so we're very kind of like spiritually at home there, but I remember when I was sitting on the beach earlier, I was remembering when I was a teenager and I used to do lots of magic mushrooms. The bay which we live has a pebble beach. Mm-hmm. And when the waves come in, it makes the pebbles roll around and make a noise. And when I was high on magic mushrooms, I thought it was like a big bowl of Rice Krispies you know, the cereal, and it was going snap, crackle and pop. And the whole bay was like a massive bowl of Rice Krispies.
That's a cool idea.
Yes. And so as I was sitting on the beach, I remembered this from being a teenager, and I had not thought about it for a long time. So yes, that was my latest one.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, I would say, like, your guys, your sound broadens a bit. Yeah, you started out with the trip hop label, but it became much more over the years. What was the craziest idea you guys ever had that didn't see the light of day, that got scrapped eventually? Like an experiment you never said, oh, we don't publish that.
I don't know. I think we ended up publishing all the crazy ideas. We used to try and get two different kinds of music and put them together. Like the song part of the process, we wanted it to sound like the Wu-Tang Clan playing with like a country band, like a country sort of, not like Zydeco, but like, you know, sort of Southern Louisiana sort of country music. So I was playing the slide guitar, and we had a guy called Pierre Leroux from New Orleans playing Cajun fiddle on it. And that worked really well, surprisingly, because we wouldn't think it did. You know, we had like a sort of slowed down hip hop beat with like a drone synthesizer. And it was basically like it just worked. And so after that, we decided that we should do that more often. You know, we should just mix different ideas together.
Mm-hmm. So do you still feel comfortable when a media labels you as like a trip hop band, or is that something you guys think about?
Not really. I mean, I don't really care about much anymore these days. I think when we were younger, we were very serious, and we wanted to be, I don't know. I think when you're younger, you just want to be cool. And trip hop was kind of cool, but we didn't feel it was fair to us because we had more different things we wanted to do. So it felt a little bit confining, but then as we grew older, we realized it was quite a cute label, you know, and trip hop was a generalized umbrella term because underneath it, you could make any kind of music you wanted, but as long as it had a slow beat and you could smoke a joint to it, it was considered trip hop. And also that there hasn't been much different kinds of music since then. There hasn't been like lots of different genres come along and make us feel old fashioned. Like I've been waiting for the new punk rock or the new hip hop to come along and make us feel like old people, but it hasn't. I think music has just become very sort of homogenized, where everything is fragmented and everybody uses a little bit of everything. And there isn't scenes anymore. You know, there isn't like a sort of self-contained sections of the music business. So yeah, it doesn't feel too bad, and I think a lot of really good new artists sound quite like trip hop anyway, you know, bands like the XX or Alt J or Flying Lotus or Arlo Parks. I mean, they all kind of just sound like trip hop.
Did you guys see trip hop as part of movement? Did you feel like being part of a movement? Like in retrospect, it seems like a huge contrast to those kind of Britpop that was dominating back then. Yeah, the loudness, the boldness, and here the chill.
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah. It was like the shadow of Britpop, you know, and we would be in the chill out room coming down from acid or something, while all the noisy kids were listening to Oasis in the other room. But I would say, I mean, I remember when we were first starting and we were trying to get a record deal and nobody was really understanding what we were trying to do. We were influenced a lot by American hip hop, but none of us felt like British people could rap. It's sort of, we felt like the British accent didn't really work. And so instead we would have singers, you know, female singers, singing over the top of the beats we'd make. And then I remember Portishead being on TV, and they were signed to Island Records, I think, or Parlophone, And they started to sell records. And then all the A&R people that were saying that they didn't really like what we were doing suddenly changed their minds. And they said, oh, okay, yeah, maybe we understand what you're doing now. And that was good because we felt part of a scene where there was other people doing similar stuff. A little bit different, but, you know, in the same kind of area. Portishead were more influenced by soundtracks, you know, like spy movies and things like that. And Massive Attack were more influenced by Jamaican music and the sound system style. So we were kind of, and we weren't from the West Country. They were all from Bristol, and we were from London. And so I think we had a slightly different attitude, but it was still nice to be part of a scene that is remembered to this day, you know, and we did our little bit to change music. Mm-hmm.
The song that was then the big breakthrough for you guys internationally was Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. Is it true that I think it was Sky who said that in an interview, like at first she didn't feel that song while recording it? She didn't get it, so to speak?
Yeah.
Answer?
I wrote the song. I remember my brother was saying that we needed to write something a bit happier or a bit more upbeat, because in general, when I write music, it's always very slow and very moody, you know, in like minor keys. I listen to a lot of people like Neil Young and, you know, that kind of slow, mopey, like late 60s, early 70s rock and things like that. But I do really love soul music, you know. My mum brought me up listening to Stax Records, you know, Otis Redding, Booker T and Sam and Dave, people like that, and Aretha Franklin. And so I tried to write something like, you know, more soul-y, and I came up with a melody, and I had an idea for the lyric as well. I just had a new girlfriend at the time and I was feeling in love. And so I managed to find within my dark beating heart a little bit of positivity and wrote a positive song. And when we first played it to Sky, I think she didn't feel quite comfortable singing something so like anthemic. But by the time we'd done some shows and she was singing it live on stage, she got into the character. And now, you know, we always play that song and everybody sings along. So I think sometimes that happens with songs. Your first impression isn't necessarily the one that you're going to carry for the rest of your life.
So she grew comfortable with it. It's not like a situation like The Cure with Friday I'm in Love, where suddenly everyone thinks you're a pop band.
There was a bit of a problem with that. A lot of our early fans didn't understand why we were doing this. I think we'd been touring for about 4 or 5 years, and the sets were very downbeat, and we were like, it would be great to play something more like upbeat and everyone dance, you know. And it's like, we're not always in a bad mood, sometimes we are happy. And so I think it upset some people at the time, but then, you know, as you go through your career, you have different feelings and different you know, ranges of emotion within your music, and in the end it all becomes part of a spectrum. And your fans can see your different moods. And Rome was just one of those. It was like a real peak, you know. And the people that didn't like it were the people that liked our first record. But then we found loads of new fans. And it really helped us. You know, we got on like The Late Show in America with Jay Leno. They had us on the TV and being interviewed and stuff. And so it opened new doors for us. So we can't really regret that, if you know what I mean. In a sense, it is a little bit sad that we broke the seal, you know, of our cool trip hop label. But at the same time, it opened new doors, and we got to experience the world.
How did you guys cope with that newfound popularity back then? Was it overwhelming at first, like being suddenly on the big stage, or was that something you guys were cool with from the...
I didn't really mind. I never felt nervous playing. Sky found it a bit nerve-wracking. She gets stage fright. I didn't really care too much. But I would say one thing that none of us really wanted to become famous. We we wanted to make music, but we didn't want to go to like a celebrity parties or be on, you know, in magazines about celebrities and things like that. So I think we shied away. We probably had the opportunity to do those kinds of things, and we shied away from it and said we just wanted to go back in the studio and make more music.
Mm-hmm. How's the relationship with the song nowadays? There are bands who like sometimes get tired of their biggest hit. I think the Dexys, they come on Eileen. Did that ever?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think Kevin Rowland played, because we're on the same label now as Dexys Midnight Runner. And I think he plays it alternately. So on one show, he'll play, what's the other song? Is it Rudy? And then he'll play Come On Eileen at another. So depending on what night you see them, you might not get to hear that song. We don't take it that far. We always play Rome Was Built in a Day towards the end of the set, and we do like it. And normally by that point in the set, we've had a few beers and maybe a tequila. So we kind of have a good time. But yeah, it can get annoying playing the same songs all the time. But, you know, we're very lucky to have had the career that we've had. And so, you know, songs like that, we owe the audience to play that song, because some of them want to come and hear that song. And we're not the kind of musicians that are grumpy and want to, you know, fight with the audience. So we're quite happy to play it.
But it's quite an interesting business model. Yeah, you can you make people buy two tickets for two shows.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's an interesting model. Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, my favorite band is Dinosaur Jr. and they always play the song Freak Scene, but when it comes to the guitar solo, Jay Maskis just plays absolute noise. You know, he doesn't play the melody anymore. He just goes, because you can tell he really hates playing it every night. So maybe sometimes like that, I'll just play a bad guitar solo in the outro of Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. I'll just you know, turn on the fuzz pedal and go crazy.
You mentioned Sky had a stage fright. Is that something you also dealt with?
No, I think the one thing that I'm confident about in my life is that I can play the guitar okay. Everything else in my life I'm nervous about, but not that.
Do you have a ritual before entering stage?
We used to do a shot of tequila and, you know, do like a group hug and be ready, but we're trying to drink less these days because, you know, we don't want to die early. And it's also, you can't really sustain that level of like partying every night for months on end. We used to be able to, but not now. So now we have to pick our, you know, we'll say on Friday we're going to have a few drinks. And so this now we just kind of we listen to some like music to get us going backstage. We'll normally listen to something really silly, like you know, like AC/DC or something like that. And just try and get hyped up, because we want to be in the moment and we want the audience to enjoy it. I think a lot of people just go around playing shows like it's their job, you know, and for us, it's our whole life.
Well, it's interesting that you say AC/DC, like it's those bands you would never expect.
Yeah, I know, but a lot of those bands, you know, that's where a lot of the best drum breaks come from. And growing up listening to hip hop and stuff, you know, if there wasn't When the Levee Breaks, then you wouldn't have the Beastie Boys.
Recently, I talked to Macy Gray, and she listens to Britney Spears before she enters the stage. This I also didn't expect.
No. No, that's funny. Yeah. No, we listen to some pretty sort of crappy stuff and just like 80s hits and things. We just try to be, you know, in a good mood, and because things always go wrong as well. And sometimes on stage you can get like upset because things aren't going the way you want them to. And you have to just kind of get that out of your mind and carry on. You know, the show must go on, as they say.
Mm-hmm. What was the wildest thing that ever happened on stage? Or the thing that went wrong memorably?
There's been a lot. I don't know. I remember the first time we played Glastonbury in England, and it was on my birthday. And I was only, I think, 18 or 19. And I took quite a lot of LSD before the show. And I was in the in the healing field or something, having like a head massage. And I could hear over the speakers them shouting, like, "Is Ross Godfrey in the audience? You have to come to the stage." And I was just, I was like, "Hold on, that's me." And I ran to the stage, and we went on, and I was very, very high and hallucinating. And there was about 40,000 people all singing along. And I had a great time, but I was very, very out of it. And it was broadcast on TV, you know, and my mum was at home watching it. It was very funny. So we used to do that sort of stuff quite a lot. But we've also had some very funny encounters in places like, I remember once we did a tour of China, and we played in the university, and everybody was sat down, and we were trying to get them to stand up and dance. And every time they did, they had like the military police there, and they would come over with a baton and they would say, "Sit down," and they would try and hit them. And in the end, we had like a row of riot police in front of the stage. And, you know, Morcheeba aren't a very aggressive band, so it was very weird to have that, you know. And in the end, the captain, the man in charge of all the police, was standing at the front shouting at everyone, and Sky bent down and she picked off his hat and she threw it like a frisbee into the crowd. And he was so angry, he came up on stage and tried to arrest Sky while we were playing the show. And that really felt like it felt like something from the 60s, you know, from like the Doors, or, you know, it was an outrageous scene. But I guess it was because it was in China and they were very repressed, you know, and that was really fun. To think back on those kind of times is good. We were a lot more willing to take risks in those days, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You still like being on the road? Is that something you guys enjoy?
Yeah, I mean, we all have families. I mean, I've got two children. Sky's actually got four children. So we have to have a bit of a balance. We can't just go on the road for months and months, you know. I think in October, we were on the road for about 3.5 weeks, which is the longest we would have done for a long time. So we just have to make sure we have breaks in between. And then I think next year we're going to do Australia, South America, North America, but not USA. And, you know, we just try to make it as comfortable as possible, because we're a bit older now. So we need access to nice hotels and swimming pools and things like that to try and stay fit. There's no more kind of just sleeping in the back of a van. We can't do that anymore. We just wake up and, you know, we have a bad back or a crook in our neck, and we can't dance and play. So I think we just have to look after ourselves. But we do enjoy touring. We love traveling. We love going to all the places, you know, all the cities that we've been many times before. But we've made friends in lots of the places. So it's just wonderful to come back. I mean, Sky's best friend lives in Munich. Mm-hmm. And so she's very excited to go there, and we're gonna have a party after the show in Munich. And you know, it's just lovely as well seeing the people, the fans, come along to the show, some of which we see every time, some people you don't see for a while. And we're just very lucky to be still doing this, you know. It's much better than having a normal job.
The band was always like a family business in some kind of way. Yeah? Like Sky's husband is on stage with you guys. Obviously, your brother was part of the band for a long time. How's the relationship nowadays? Are you guys on good terms again? Or?
I mean, we speak to each other, but it's, I don't know. It's mixed, really. My brother has a studio down on the South Coast, and he makes music still. And it's, you know, we talk about the old records, and we have to look after our catalogue and things like that. So there is still communication there, but I don't think that we'd get back together anytime soon. And also, you know, Paul didn't spend too much time on the road before. I think he found that harder. So even from, like, you know, the first and second album, it would just be Sky and I on the road most of the time. So that doesn't really feel like it's changed too much. But, you know, Paul was a very big part of the band when we started, to help craft the sound, and he used to write a lot of the lyrics and things like that. So, you know, there is, we do miss him in the sense, but it's, you know, life moves on and everybody kind of grows in different directions. So we just kind of try to keep everything as amicable as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said you come to Germany for three shows now. What can fans expect? What do you guys plan?
Well, I would probably say that we'll do something like a 90, 100-minute set. So we're not quite at Bruce Springsteen levels yet, but we're getting there. We're nearly at 2 hours. And
I was one time at a concert of him. He played like 3.5 to 4 hours really back then.
Yeah.
Everyone was so tired in the audience. Like, that guy still kept going, and we were like, oh my God.
Yeah. he's a hero of mine. I love Bruce, and I've seen him probably about 7 or 8 times. And yeah, you're right. Once it gets to nearly the fourth hour, you keep looking at your watch thinking, oh my God. And he never goes off to go to the toilet. How does he, you know, he must be dying for a piss. anyway, so we'll play a lot of older songs, a lot of people's favorite songs, and we'll probably play 4 or 5 new songs as well. As well as we throw in like a cover. We'll probably, you know, pick a song, one of our favorite songs from, you know, a Spotify playlist and learn to play that. So we try to put in a little bit of spontaneity and jams and make it interesting and different every night, because, you know, we're not really robots. We don't like playing the same thing. We don't play to like a click track or any backing stuff. It's all completely live.
Mm-hmm. And AI, does that somehow play a role for you guys in terms of making graphics, designs?
No. I mean, I don't really like AI. It doesn't feel right. It's soulless.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't even really like working with computers to make music. I'd prefer to carry on with tape machines and drum machines and samplers and stuff. But, you know, obviously it's a lot easier to use Pro Tools and to arrange music. I mean, I can do, in one day, I can do the same sort of work that it used to take us a week to do with tape. But I think that technology makes it too easy, and it makes it possible for people that can't really make music to make music, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because in the old days you had to be very talented to make a record, and now you can just say anything into a microphone and then put it in time, put it in pitch. It's a bit of a cheat. So I'm not interested in using AI for anything.
Yeah, same here. I'm not a fan either. Yeah.
Although I would say it is very interesting when you can you can solo an instrument from an old record. So I just want to hear the guitar solo from a Jimi Hendrix record so I can work it out. AI is good for that.
Did the Beatles use it
it was from the guy Peter Jackson, I think, who did Get Back. They developed it so they could remix the jams that were all bounced onto one channel. And it is incredible, but, you know, it's more like a gimmick than a usable tool.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's a lot of fun. We look forward to see you guys in Germany.